This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
It's been 17 years since the euro was introduced to world financial markets, amid high hopes by its creators that this currency experiment would promote prosperity and increase political and social cohesion throughout Europe. As an economist, Joseph Stiglitz has been fascinated by the euro because, as he notes in the preface of his new book, economists don't normally do laboratory experiments. But he also finds the whole effort deeply flawed and holds the eurozone project responsible for impeding growth, fostering divisiveness, and exacerbating, if not causing, many of Europe's current economic problems. Over the past half century, Professor Stiglitz has, of course, become one of the most accomplished economists of our era, with influential work spanning the worlds of academia, public policy, and popular literature. He's taught at Princeton, Stanford, MIT, and Oxford, and for the past decade and a half at Columbia University. He headed the Council of Economic Advisors under President Clinton and has served as chief economist at the World Bank and as head of several international commissions or expert groups. In 2001, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his analyses of markets with asymmetric information, and he shared in the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize as the lead author of the 1995 report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. After many years of writing academic papers, Professor Stiglitz in the past decade and a half or so has demonstrated a knack for writing articles and books that have made complex economic ideas accessible and interesting to the general public. Since the early years of the Bush administration, he's written or co-authored 10 books, I think this is now his 11th, on such topical issues as globalization, financial market deregulation, and remedies for recovering from the Great Recession. In his new book, The Euro, Professor Stiglitz argues that there should be a fundamental restructuring of the eurozone, as well as reforms of policies imposed on member countries. Failing that, he outlines a couple of alternatives, including either the creation of what he calls the flexible euro, or a carefully managed dissolution of the eurozone. A review in the Financial Times called Professor Stiglitz's critique of eurozone policies, quote, original and extremely helpful. And a Wall Street Journal review said many of the book's most damning observations are, quote, on target. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Joseph Stiglitz.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here again at Politics and Prose, and wonderful to see so many people interested in the subject. One of the questions I always get asked is, you know, why should an American be writing about the euro? Doesn't America have enough problems of its own that I should be writing about? And the answer is yes, of course, we do have a lot of problems. But as he pointed out, we don't yet have a lot of experiments. Maybe Trump will give us another experiment. No, that was wrong. The euro is a fascinating experiment to an economist, and economists love data. In this case, it's been a little bit at a cost of a lot of people in Europe, and I'll try to describe that in a few minutes. There are a couple of other reasons why the euro is so interesting, should be so interesting to Americans. One of the big issues that's been very clear in this campaign is a concern about globalization, and about globalization that's moved out of sync with economic globalization moved out of sync with political, with politics. The euro is an experiment a little bit along the same lines, more limited. It's just Europe. They integrated economically, and the euro was a big step forward, a single currency, but the politics weren't going with it. And the result of that is a dysfunctional Europe that is having enormous costs. So that was one of the motivations as a way of seeing at a small scale of region what happens to globalization when it doesn't work well. The second thing, reason why this is so interesting is a single currency is about finance. I mean, currency is about how we transact money. It's about money. And at the core of a lot of the problems going on in the global markets are global finance. It was what gave rise to the 2008 crisis. So a story about the euro is a story about finance and ideas about finance, about ideas about economics, which had a lot of sway, but unfortunately, in many ways, were not quite correct. And the consequences, again, have been very severe. So for those of you who haven't followed the full story of the euro, let me just go through it fairly quickly. It's a story that really begins with good intentions. Europe, after World War II, decided that they needed some new institutions to prevent a recurrence of the two world wars that had been so devastating. And there were a number of initiatives. You know, the UN started in 1944 as another way of preventing it. In the case of Europe, the economics and the politics were always intertwined. The European integration movement began with the European coal and steel community. And then it went beyond that to broader forms of economic integration, taking down all trade barriers. But they did a number of things that went far beyond what we have talked about in the United States in terms of economic integration. You know, a lot of discussion now about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, and before NAFTA, there was an agreement between Canada and the United States. And Canada and the United States are very similar societies, speak the same language. But when we started having economic integration, it was very limited. It was only the free movement of goods and services. Not what they did, which is free migration of labor. That was a big deal, movement of labor throughout the European Union. And this book is about the next stage in that experiment, not only free movement of goods and services, free movement of labor, free movement of capital, but a single currency shared originally by a small group of countries, but now by 19 different countries. And that was a big deal. One has to see what was going on in historical context. The big event affecting many of us now take almost for granted was the fall of the Iron Curtain. In 1989-90. That had a very big impact on views about economics. It was thought that the fall of the Iron Curtain was a victory for capitalism. And it proved that the market economy really worked really well. But it wasn't. It was really a statement about the failure of communism and that communism worked really, really badly. And we took away the wrong lesson, and the lesson that a lot of people said was, you know, we can trust the market, and I'll come back to that. So there was a real strong faith after that in markets working well on their own. It wasn't long after that this stage in European integration began. In 1992, there was the Maastricht Convention where they agreed on the formation of the euro. They agreed on the set of rules that would govern the euro. And those set of rules were predicated on a particular view of how the economy worked. That view was very much that if government just did its part, the market would do the rest. And what do they mean by the government doing its part? It wasn't very complicated. All you had to do is make sure the government did not have too large of a deficit. They picked a number out of the air, no scientific basis, but It was 3% ratio of deficit to GDP. And the debt couldn't be more than 60% of GDP. You know, if you ask an economist, where do those numbers come from? There's no basis. And then there were the other part was, you can't have inflation. Inflation was really bad. So they said inflation had to be kept low, and they gave a mandate to their central bank, the European Central Bank, which they created, a single bank for all of these countries, to focus only on inflation. Now, to an American, that sounds strange, because the Federal Reserve, as you may know, focuses on inflation, employment, growth. Right now, we're talking a lot about employment and financial stability. It didn't focus enough on financial stability before 2008. But they have a mandate to focus just on inflation. And to put a little bit in perspective, in, when I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors in 1996, one of the Republican senators said, you know, look at what's going on in Europe. We should imitate them. And we should change the charter of the Federal Reserve to focus only on inflation. And I said, you know, this is wonderful. I said, President Clinton, why don't you make this a campaign issue in, you know, do American people care about jobs? Do they want the Federal Reserve to ignore employment or just focus on inflation? And the moment, of course, that the president said, yeah, this is an important issue, the Republicans said, oh, no, we didn't really mean that. That was just a joke. So in fact, that particular initiative to focus only on inflation died. The euro was shaped of that particular moment in history where it started. As I say, 1992 was when they wrote down the rules. The exchange rates were fixed with each other in 1999. And the euro came into existence in 2002. 2005, they were celebrating, things were working, looking wonderful. And they, people in Europe were saying, oh, you skeptics, see, the euro is wonderful. 2008, just 6 years after the introduction of the euro, things began to look not so wonderful. And economists had said the real test of the euro would come when it was a shock, when there was a shock. You know, something which they had to absorb, like a decrease in demand, demand for their goods, which, of course, the shock coming from America, our financial crisis, was a very, very big shock. And the worry was that when you have this single currency over a large number of countries, you had taken away two of the most important adjustment mechanisms in responding to a shock, that is to say, the interest rate, you lower interest rates and that stimulates the economy, exchange rate, you lower your exchange rate and that stimulates demand for your exports. They'd taken away those two instruments and they hadn't put anything in its place. And so economists said, the test of the euro is not whether it does well in 2003, 4, and 5, it's what happens when there's a shock. And 2008 really proved their worries were serious. The euro has done, the Eurozone has done abysmally. It was, as I say, founded on the best of ideals. It wanted to bring the countries of Europe together. It was a political project with the idea that, you know, it wasn't economists that were behind. It was a political project, that the idea that the euro would bring a lot of prosperity, that prosperity would enhance the degree of solidarity among European citizens. Sharing a single currency would be giving them a sense of identity, and that would then further the European project, the project of European integration. Unfortunately, at that moment in 1992, the sense of European identity, solidarity, was not strong enough to do what was required to make a single currency work, given the diversity of countries within the euro. And they knew that. But the hope was that in the ensuing years, the success of the euro, the prosperity that it would bring, would, there was a theory of political reform that that would in turn lead to greater willingness to, you might say, finish the project, to do the other things that were necessary, and that would, a virtuous circle that would then enhance greater European integration. What's happened, of course, is being just the opposite. Because the institutions that would make a single currency work weren't put in place, the Eurozone, when it was afflicted by this crisis, by this disturbance coming from across the waters, it would have happened anyway, but the precipitating event was the 2008 American crisis. It led to recessions, depressions, and rather than economic prosperity, it's been just the opposite. And rather than solidarity, it's actually led to more political divisiveness than I've ever seen in a half a century. So let me just describe in a few minutes what's happened to their economy. You know, the crisis began in the United States. We have a recovery, a weak recovery, but still a recovery. They're really still in stagnation. Many of the countries, the crisis countries, are in depression. And when I say depression, I use that word advisedly. The economic downturns in Spain and Greece and Portugal and Ireland were greater than the Great Depression. The Greek downturn was more than 25%. The unemployment rate in these countries, in Spain, you know, they celebrate in Spain, Europe is celebrating, they say things are really on the mend. Unemployment is only 20%. And youth unemployment is only 50%. And it's, of course, been that way for a long time. Of course, 20% is better than 25%. But at this pace, they'll be back to normal sometime in the middle of the next decade. Young people who've been out of a job for a very long time, really eroding the basis of their society. So, you know, I could go through the statistics, but I think the point should be clear that, you know, that this has been a terrible, hard to describe how bad economic episode. The question is why, and to me, the single explanation is the euro. Now, there's a debate about what aspect of the euro. And there are some people, including one of the writers from the Financial Times, who argue there was nothing wrong with the euro, it was only the policymakers. They had the wrong policies. And let me say, he's right. The policymakers were terrible. They couldn't have done worse. Well, yes, they could have. But they did a really, really bad job. But the point of my book is to argue that even if you had the most brilliant policymakers, given the structure, the rules that they had set up in 1992, it could not have worked. And, you know, it could not have worked without their changing those rules. One of the problems is not only didn't they have enough economic similarity of the countries to share this common currency, they didn't have enough political congruence, political, not only solidarity, but perspective on what makes for a good economy. You can't write down everything ahead of time. You have to have, you do need policymakers to make a decision. But if the policymakers have very different views of what makes for good economics, then you're going to have divisiveness. And it's going to be hard to have consistency. And it's going to be, things won't work. One side is going to be imposing policies on the other side. And there's going to be a lot of unhappiness. Now, the particular example I've already mentioned, they had the view that all you needed to make the economies function well is to keep deficits low. That theory, most economists didn't think was right in the beginning. But then, looked at the crisis, it became clear that that theory was wrong. Ireland and Spain, two of the countries that had crises, let me step back. You know, Greece did have a problem with fiscal profligacy. So you can have a problem with fiscal profligacy. I mean, that's right. And Greece is what everybody talks about. One has to remember that the United States was complicitous, or American firms were complicitous in Greece's problem, because Goldman Sachs derivatives were designed to hide what was going on inside Greece. So we helped the Greek government hide their deficits. So Greece is the story of profligacy. But Ireland and Spain actually had a surplus before the crisis. So you can't blame deficits, you can't blame profligacy as the source of that crisis. If Greece was the only country that had a problem, there wouldn't be a euro crisis. Greece is a small country, 10 million people. We would say the Greek crisis. We wouldn't say the euro crisis. But the fact is, it is many, many countries around Europe. And even the countries that are not really in crisis, Italy and France, are near crisis. I won't say how near, because I don't want to call it a panic. But they're, things are not going well, and they know that, and everybody knows that, and there are potentially real problems, particularly right now in Italy. So when you have so many countries having difficulties, countries that before 2008 were growing strongly, countries that before the euro were doing well. Their standard of living was low because some of these countries didn't have the human capital, didn't have structural problems, but they were still growing and they were catching up. But the euro has meant that, as a large numbers are not doing well. So if you have so many countries that are having difficulty, you have to conclude it's a systemic problem. And that leads to a need for a systemic analysis. What is the source of the problem? So much of my book is to trying to explain why it's not just the policies, it's the structure. Unfortunately, when Germany looked at the facts, you know, of the crisis, and they've become the dominant power in what is going on, in dictating the terms of what the countries are in crisis are doing, and even more broadly in the Eurozone, their interpretation is to double down on a failed experiment. In other words, they rather than saying what I just said, well, you know, deficits are a problem, but there's something else going on. They've ignored Ireland, Spain, Portugal, all these other examples, and keep focusing on Greece. And they said, what we have to do is more austerity, more budget cutting, make sure the countries don't violate the deficits. But the deficits weren't the problem. The downturn caused the deficits and the debt, not the other way around. So it reminds me a little bit of medieval blood letters. When medieval bloodletting, remember the theory was that when you were sick, it was because you had bad humors in your blood, and the only way to get rid of the bad humors was to get rid of the blood. And they would have leeches, a big market for leeches, then they would leech out the blood. And typically, as one could imagine, when you did that, the patient didn't thrive. And when they started getting sicker and sicker, the medieval doctor said, oh, obviously the answer is we haven't let enough blood out. And most of the patients died, but one of the wonders of the mind is a few patients survived by a miracle. And those were the ones that they would talk about. And they would say, see, it works. But of course, 99% of the time it didn't. Well, Germany's attitude was a little bit the same. Austerity has essentially never worked. But they still believe it works. They've doubled down on that recipe, and the bloodletting patients are getting sicker and sicker. So, okay, sorry about that. Okay, start all over again, okay. So let me very briefly describe some of the structural problems that I think of as inherent in the structure of the Eurozone. The first I've already talked about, this restriction, two of them I've already talked about, the single-minded focus on inflation in the European Central Bank, that was part of the structure. A second one is the single-minded focus on the deficit. They had taken away, as I said, the two of the adjustment mechanisms, the exchange rate and the interest rate, hadn't put anything in its place, but instead actually tied the hands by saying you can't use fiscal policy and you can't use monetary policy to stimulate the economy. They understood that they wanted to have the countries converge, get more similar, but they put in place rules that actually led to the countries getting further and further apart, to divergence rather than convergence. Let me just give you one example. Again, think about what happened after 2008 crisis. The crisis originated in the United States. Our banks had done a terrible job of managing risk. Normally, you think, you know, if a country's mismanaged risk that badly, money would leave. What happened after in 2009, after the crisis, you know? Where did the money go? Money came into the United States. Now, why? Well, very simple reason. I was on a conference call after Lehman Brothers went down. The Democratic Party was trying to decide what was their response going to be to the Bush initiative for a $700 billion bailout of the banks. And most of the people on the conference call were from bankers, you know, well-known bankers, I won't mention any names. And there were a couple of us who were economists. And the bankers' initial reaction was, why only $700 billion? And the answer was, you know, $1 trillion sounded too big. But don't worry, if you need more, there's more for you when you need it. So, you know, don't get upset. This is just the first beginning of the bailout if you need more. Well, that was actually very important because what it was saying to the world was that America was standing behind the banks and would bail out, you know, so money flowed here. There's a very important principle. Behind the banks of any country is the government. So now, let's go back to Europe. You have your money, your euros in Spanish banks, and there's a worry whether there's a problem in the Spanish banks. What are you going to do? You have a choice of keeping your money in the Spanish banks with a Spanish government that's on the ropes, or putting your money in a German bank where you have a strong government standing behind the German banks. Well, it's obvious. Money starts leaving Spain and going to Germany. Well, what happens then? Well, the Spanish banks get weaker and weaker. They can't lend to the private sector, especially to small and medium-sized enterprise. Those enterprises have to contract. They get weaker. Tax revenues go down, and the Spanish government gets even weaker. And confidence in the Spanish banking system gets weaker. So it's a vicious downward circle, and what's happening? Germany's getting stronger. Spain is getting weaker. The poor countries are getting poorer, and the rich countries are getting richer. So they had created unintentionally the system of divergence. And there are several other aspects of this kind of divergence. Free mobility of labor meant the most talented people, the people who were most easily could get jobs in London, would leave Greece, leaving those who were unskilled labor behind. So capital was leaving Greece, talented labor was leaving Greece, and no wonder then the Greek economy wasn't functioning very well. But think about that. The debt was a burden on anybody who stayed in Greece. But you didn't have to pay back the debt if you moved out of Greece. It's a very strange system. You inherit debt, but only if you stay in Greece. So again, the system of place-based debt created an incentive for people to leave the poor countries and move to the rich. But then, of course, the system of fiscal constraints meant that Greece could, and Spain and the other, couldn't invest in infrastructure and technology and education, again, leading to greater divergence between the rich and the poor. So this was another example of a built-in structural problem that made it impossible for anybody, no matter the best of policymakers, to deal with it. Maybe most fundamentally was the following. When you fix the exchange rate, it means that if your exchange rate may be out of kilter. In other words, economists believe very strongly in the use of prices as a way of adjusting. If your exchange rate is wrong, it means your imports are greater than your exports. And that means you have to borrow money to finance the deficit of imports over exports. But what happens if nobody's willing to lend you money to finance your imports? Well, that's a crisis. Well, normally what happens is the exchange rate adjusts and makes your exports cheaper and your imports more expensive, and that's the way you bring back imports to exports. But they couldn't do that because the exchange rate was fixed. That was what it was meant to be in a single currency. So what matters, though, of course, is what we call the real exchange rate. Exchange rate taking into account price levels in different countries. So there were two other ways of equilibrating, of adjusting. One, prices in Germany could go up. And the other one is prices in Greece could go down. Well, you can say, what difference does it make? Aren't those equivalent? And the answer is no. When prices go down, let's call it internal devaluation. When prices go down, think about, you know, the people in Ireland or Greece owe money in euros. You borrow money to buy a house, you owe money in euros. Just like we borrow money and buy, you know, a mortgage in dollars. What would happen if all of a sudden you're told that your wages are going to be cut by 25 or 40%? You borrowed money assuming that your wages are going to be roughly the same as they are today. And all of a sudden you're told by Germany, I'm sorry, that was a nice idea, but you're going to have to take a 25 or 40% wage cut. Well, you get economic chaos. People can't pay back their debts. The banks are even weaker. The alternative, Germany raising their prices and wages, actually makes it easier for them to pay back their debts. The crisis is often described as a problem of leverage, excess leverage. But what does internal devaluation, lowering wages and prices? It increases effective leverage. And so the solution to a problem of leverage was to increase leverage. Well, obviously, that was not a solution. That was a way of perpetuating the crisis, and that's precisely what happened. They didn't build in any mechanism for forcing the countries with surplus, like Germany, to adjust their surpluses, to raise their prices. And instead, they put all the burden of adjustment on the countries at the bottom. And that was a recipe for failure. So those were some of the structural problems that were really built into the Eurozone and why it would have been impossible for even the best of policymakers to make it work. But in addition, they then had the wrong policies. I already talked about one aspect of the policies was this extreme austerity. The cutbacks in government expenditure, which simply led the countries to go further and further down. But they also talked about structural reforms, not the structural reforms that I've been talking about, where I say you need a structural reform in the structure of the Eurozone itself. They talked about structural reforms in the individual countries. It was sort of a blame the victim idea. You know, it was a problem of Greece or a problem of Spain. It was every country had a problem, and it was there. They were paying the price for their sins is what it was. And that made people feel good. It wasn't the euro. It was the sins of the individual countries. And it was only through suffering that they would get redemption. So that was the sort of idea that people had in mind. So suffering and the reform of the structural of the economy. But when you started looking at the structural reforms that they were arguing for, your mind began to spin and you understood something else was going on. Let me just give you one example that I find so illustrative. Greece was having this terrible crisis. GDP was down 25%. I thought, you know, unemployment was 25%, youth unemployment 50%. And the Troika, this IMF, ECB, European Central Bank, and the European Commission that were administering the programs, said to Greece, began a discussion, you have to change your regulations about fresh milk. Yeah, you look puzzled. I'm literally through. How many days old should milk be and still be labeled fresh? Greece had a regulation that it was 4 days. If it's older than 4 days, it's no longer fresh. And the Troika said, we want 10 days. Now you say, why are they meddling into the definition of fresh milk? Well, it turns out, you know, I've asked around. I think I found the answer, and that is the Dutch milk producers wanted to be able to ship their milk from Northern Europe down to Greece, and they couldn't do it in 4 days. And they wanted to be able to sell their milk that was 7-8 days old as fresh milk. But of course, if you were thinking about this from the perspective of Greece, this would hurt Greece. Greece's farmers would not be able to compete with the industrial milk of Netherlands. Their employment would go down, their incomes would go down, their imports would go up. So their balance of payments would be worse off, their GDP would go down. This was not in the interest of Greece. But the Troika was not asking what was good for Greece. They were asking what was in the interest of some special interest all over Europe that were having a field day now that Germany was running the show. And there are many other examples of that that I talk about in the book. And you say, you know, it's fascinating, it's sort of a detective work, and it's mystifying all at the same time. So let me be very quick. Where do you go from here? To me, there are basically two directions. You either have to have more Europe or less Europe. The halfway house where they're now doesn't work. More Europe would be the kinds of reforms that are needed to make a single currency work over a diverse group of countries, like common deposit insurance, so money doesn't run out from Spain when there's a problem. Some way of facilitating countries borrowing in euros collectively, a reform of the European Central Bank to make it focus on inflation, not just on inflation, but also employment and growth. They follow pretty much from the diagnosis of what I described before as the structural problems of the Eurozone itself. So that's one way. The other way is less of the Eurozone, less Europe. And that entails, I describe two alternatives. One is what I call an amicable divorce. No divorce is ever amicable, but you could be more amicable, and it what I describe is how it could be done in a way that causes a minimal amount of disturbance. A lot of people say, well, isn't that going to be very costly? And what I keep reminding people, the current status quo is extraordinarily costly. If you're out of a job for, you know, years and years and years, that's very costly. And so the transition would be costly, but at least there would be hope at the end of the road. In the current system, there's very little hope. And then I talk about a system of a flexible euro, which keeps the ambition of a single currency, but recognize they put the cart before the horse. They weren't ready for it. Let's have a pause. Let's try to create the institutions that would make a single currency work. And when we can show those institutions are working by the ability to keep exchange rates roughly aligned with each other, then go ahead and finish the experiment and go back to having a single currency. I think that could work as well. And people ask, well, where do I think Europe is going to go? Political forecasting is even more difficult than economic forecasting. But I think it's pretty clear, while what I describe as what is necessary to make the euro work is not a lot economically, far less than what we have in the United States of America. You know, it's nothing like what we have. We have single currency. It works among 50 states. But you don't need all that to make the euro work. But it is more than I think Europe is willing to have today. It's more than Germany is willing. Germany says Europe is not a transfer union. What that words mean, if you're not, what it means is we are not willing to help our neighbors. We aren't willing to transfer resources. We aren't even willing to engage in a mutual insurance agreement, because if we did that, they would take advantage of us. There's a lot, you know, not a high level of trust. So you can't, you know, they don't want to have common deposit insurance, because they say, they talk about moral hazard. Somebody will take advantage of us. You say, well, can't you have supervision like we have? And they say, no, you know, we just don't trust. So they say Europe is not a transfer union, and they won't accept those ideas. So if you can't persuade Germany to accept more Europe, and as I say, more and more what you hear is that's not on the table, that means they have to go one of the towards one of the other forms of amicable divorce or a flexible euro. More than likely, what they're going to do, though, is the current policy muddling through. The problem with brinkmanship, which is what it is that when you are so often so close to the brink, you eventually go over the brink. You know, a year ago, we had the Greek crisis. And everybody said, we solved the Greek crisis. But we didn't. The agreement that was pushed on Greece, over the opposition of the vast majority of their citizens, 62% have voted against austerity. 62%. And they said, you know, so much for democracy, you don't have a choice in your economic policy. And the austerity they've imposed, the result of that is their GDP has continued to go down. The depression has got worse. So eventually it will break out again. So the concern is that the euro crisis is not over. Why should Americans be concerned? Well, I think there are a whole variety of reasons why we should be concerned. I'm glad there's so many people here that express at least some concern about these issues. We live in a globally integrated world. If Europe is weak and China is weak, it's going to be very hard for us to have a strong economy. So economically, it's important. But from my point of view, what's even more important is Europe has really been a beacon in so many ways. It's been the strongest advocate for climate change, a very strong advocate for human rights. There's lots of issues that we have to work towards peace. And they have been our most important ally. But if they are totally absorbed with this issue with the euro that could be solved, but they refuse to solve, then they aren't going to be able to really address adequately the bigger issues that are going to affect all of us all over the world. Thank you very much.
You did not mention Great Britain, which was not part of the Eurozone, but I'm wondering if Brexit, as it's called, will have any effect on the problems you're talking about on the continent.
Yeah. I wrote, for the English edition, an afterword on Brexit, because it is obviously important. And one of the questions is how was Brexit affected by the Eurozone? And I try to argue that actually the troubles across the Channel almost surely had a significant effect and may have pushed them over the line. Because you think about yourself in the UK, you're looking across the Channel, you see a dysfunctional Europe, you see Germany dominating the politics. You ask the question, do you want to be a member of that club? And a lot of people said, no, that's not a club I want to be a member of. And so it was a close vote. You didn't have to tilt many people's views to help lead to Brexit. The economically, it all depends. Basically, we don't know the kind of agreement that they're going to reach. And there are lots of different models out there. Norway, I should have emphasized, there are many countries in the EU that don't, not many, there are a few countries in the EU, Sweden and Denmark, that do not use the euro. And there are several other countries on the eastern side that don't use the euro. So you could be a member of the EU and not use the euro. You could be a real member of Europe, but not be part of the EU, like Norway and Switzerland. So they have a very complex set of institutional arrangements, and it's not clear which of these various forms it will take. Now, at one extreme, at one level, the United States and Canada have a lot of prosperity. We don't have free migration. We don't have, as I mentioned before, we don't have a single market, a common banking regulation. Canada's very happy that it didn't have the same bank regulators because, but we don't have a fixed exchange rate, and things work really well. I don't say really well, but they work pretty well, and that's one model of how things could evolve. Another model, Juncker, who is the head of the European Commission, after in discussing where things are going to go, said, we want to give them a really, really bad deal because we want to make sure that no one else leaves. And when he said that, I thought, this is a really peculiar view, because you would have thought he would have said, we haven't sold the virtues of the European Union. It has a lot of benefits for our people, and our job was that we didn't explain those benefits well enough. But what he said is, no, there aren't any benefits. We're going to keep it together by threat. And if that's the attitude, I think things are not going to go well.
So there's quite a line of questions. We really only have about 10 or 11 minutes.
So we'll
try to keep your questions as short as possible, please.
Okay. Relates to your amicable divorce idea, but I wanted to turn that over. Do you think things would have turned out a lot better for the Eurozone if it had been a much smaller Eurozone right from the beginning, limiting it to countries with, as you say, similar prices, similar, per capita GDP or whatever, homogeneous? And would it be better for the members of that now? Would it have turned out better for the members now of that more limited Eurozone? And would it have made things even worse for other European countries outside of the Eurozone to not have been part of the Eurozone?
No. So the two parts. One, I think a single currency among a smaller group of more similar countries would have had a much bigger chance of success. My colleague at Columbia, Bob Mundell, wrote a paper about what are the conditions under which a set of countries could share a similar currency, and he emphasized that point, the similarity of countries. Actually, I think both the countries in the single currency and the countries out of the single currency would have been better off with that formulation, because as we've seen so clearly, the countries like those in the South whose income is lower would have benefited from being able to have a lower exchange rate,
right,
and they would have been able to export. So the answer is it would have been mutually beneficial.
Right. Thanks.
Given euro bad, not euro good, why did Greece stick with the euro? Why didn't it fail?
That's a really good question. I think the answer is, talking to a lot of people in Greece, is they made they were very emotionally attached to being Europeans, and they thought that sharing that single currency was an important part of the identity of being a European. And I thought that was very foolish. You know, as I say, Sweden doesn't use the euro, and they feel very, very European. The Swiss are not even a member of the EU, and they're very European. So there are these very many arrangements, but they felt at the periphery. You have to remember, they're at the edge. For them, that badge of being that single currency turned out to have an emotional value that was not in their own interest. But the emotional content, I was at meetings where, and I explained some of the what was going on and some of the, you know, the choices and what, people would break out in tears. So it was an emotional issue.
Hi. We did well because we could print a lot of money and the world was forced to accept it because it was the best deal in town. Okay, but my question is this. We've got mega problems with configuration. We are running a lot less efficiently, both as human beings, economically, and so forth. How are we, as a people, as a species, going to start to move forward and change the configurations and do it in a way in which the general welfare is looked after as opposed to special interests? And
yep.
we have to do it. We're stuck if we stay the way we are, and we're messed up if we change. So how are we going to do that?
Well, you know, one of the things that the euro and maybe the global financial crisis brought out is our systems have gotten very complex so that it is very hard to understand. And that complexity has given a field day for some people who have some special interest to try to do things behind, you might say, closed doors, and even after they're open, it's hard to understand. Just to, you know, I don't want to digress onto a trade agreement, but TPP, 6,000 pages long. How many people do you think have read TPP, including the president? But we know, looking at inside it, that there are some things that are really, really bad that have been put there by corporate interests. So that is a part of the complexity of modern life, and one of the reasons I've been writing some of these books is that, by an attempt to, you might say, demystify some of the aspects of these issues, and the euro is being one, where I think the people there who put it together really had the best of intentions. They really thought they were going to create, they're visionaries, and they were going to create a system that would be peace in our, you know, and prosperity, and it was a move forward, and the economic complexity took hold.
Following what you say, do you think that it would be better to have two euros, one for the North, one for the South?
Yes, I think it would be certainly better to have at least two or three than the single currency. Probably would not be ideal to have 19 different currencies, and that's one of the points that I make in the book. But It is interesting, worth pointing out, that even very small countries can have their own currency and manage it. Iceland, 350,000 people, has their own currency. And because they had their own currency, even though they had one of the deepest downturns in the global financial crisis, their banks misbehaved even worse than ours. And yet they had one of the fastest bounce backs, and it was partly because of the flexibility of their exchange rate.
If you consider the U.S. monetary policy as the alternative to the European monetary policy, we've gone through several rounds of monetary expansion, right? And what has led to is enormous wealth for those that own assets and those that are in the investment class, but that prosperity has not seemed to reach like people in rural communities, and I would compare them to their like our Greece, like middle Tennessee or rural West Virginia. And it's difficult for me, I mean, if you say that this is a preferable policy, but I'm just saying it's difficult for me to see how that will ever, that preferability will ever reach them.
Now, let me say, having a central bank that focuses on not just inflation, but employment, growth, and stability, financial stability, is not guaranteeing that things are going to work, but it's better than just focusing on inflation. Now, you know, I agree with you, monetary policy has reached the limits of its ability, and we need fiscal policy. So no matter what would have been the rules, monetary policy probably would not have been adequate. But the contrast with Europe should be very clear. In 2011, Europe was going down. There were, you know, global financial that was not recovering from the global financial crisis. 2010 was the beginning of the euro crisis, the beginning of the Greek crisis. 2011, Trichet, who was the head of the ECB at the time, raised interest rates twice. Why? Because he said, you know, my job is not worrying about unemployment. So what if it's 12-15%? That's somebody else's problem. But whose it was wasn't clear. But his job was to fight inflation. He saw the inkling of inflation. There wasn't any inflation, but he saw the inkling of inflation. His job was single-minded, focused on inflation. He raised interest rates twice. So it was a bad judgment call, but you can say, given his mandate, he was just doing what he was instructed to do. Be careful about inflation. Now, the more general point you raised, I couldn't agree more. Our policies of QE without fiscal policy have not only not restored our economy to full employment, have actually led to a lot of inequality, not just the inequality that you talked about, enormous wealth inequality. Who owns the equities who've gone up as a result of the low interest rates? It's disproportionately people at the top. Who are the people who are suffering from low interest rates, the retirees who bought T-bills? So the policy, as well-intentioned as it was, has been a major source of increase in wealth inequality.
We've got time just for a couple more questions.
Well, thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. It seems to me that the situation, particularly in Greece, is really very difficult, but that there are both things to avoid and there are options that are interesting. The basis, looking at what's happened in the CFA zone in Western Central Africa, a continuation of a fixed currency regime for countries which don't have the appropriate institutions is just not an option.
Yeah.
It's credible, one. Two, a couple of countries quit the CFA zone, Madagascar and Guinea. Theirs is not an example to follow. So it seems to me that we have to come back to the lessons actually of the original approach to structural reform of the early 80s, which was to combine appropriate fiscal adjustment, but together with actual deep reforms that tackled relevant problems.
Well, let me say, I agree with the first part, but not the second part. For those of you who don't know, that West Africa shares a common currency, and it was at one point pegged to the euro. So if you think that there's a lot of diversity within Europe, you can imagine pegging Africa, these poor countries, with that was a big mistake. And among them, many economists think that was one of the reasons that many of the countries in West Africa have done so poorly. So to me, the ending of the exit from it is a necessary. But again, it's not sufficient. There are many ways you can have bad economic policy. And ingenuity in this area is unlimited. But the structural, what was called structural adjustment of the 1980s that was imposed on Africa was an utter disaster. It was a quarter century of stagnation. After a quarter century, GDP was the same roughly as it was before. And today, the level of industrialization in Africa is lower than it was 30 years ago. So that, to me, was the result of that structural adjustment policy. So in terms of, I'm very hostile to that kind of the structural adjustment policy that was imposed in those countries. But we won't be able to discuss that here. Let me just say.
A quick comeback.
No, I think he has to.
We really don't have time. We have time for one more question.
Just this morning, Mario Draghi said March 7, 2017 and beyond, possibly, for continuing asset purchases. The Italian banks, I mean, they're in, like, really bad shape. I mean, you said that Italy's not quite in crisis, but the banks are. Can you talk about that or just?
Well, as I mentioned, Italy is one of the subjects of concern right now all over the world. And the reason is that some of the banks are in a precarious position, and the problems in Italy illustrate some aspects of European diversity. One of the general rules that many people supported after the 2008 crisis was that when a bank runs into trouble, before the taxpayer comes to bail it out, the shareholders ought to bear the cost and the bondholders. And that was the big lesson of Citibank. Why did we bail it out? You could save the bank without saving the shareholders, the bondholders, and the bankers. And the European Union has adopted that basically as a principle. But then comes along Italy, where the bondholders are different than in most other countries, because the Italian banks sold to ordinary citizens bonds as if they were certificates of deposit. So if you wipe out the bondholders, you're wiping out a large number of ordinary Italians who thought they were just like ordinary deposits. And they weren't explained. These are not insured. So you have to have, so they're struggling. How do we have a system of rules that works across Europe, given the diversity within Europe? And so right now, the European Commission says you can't come to their aid. So Renzi says, I'm going to have to figure this out, because if I don't figure this out, I may lose the election. And the five-star movement, which wants to get out of the Europe totally, or out of the euro totally, is going to be in the ascendancy. So, and he's tried to hobble together something. He's failed so far by most accounts. He's not put together the kind of money that he needs to bail out one bank, let alone if there's more than one bank in trouble. And then the question, is this another example of the brinkmanship that I talked about before? They say, we're not going to allow state aid. We're not going to allow this bailout. It's called state aid is the particular provision. And but at the end, they'll give in. So no one really knows. It's another example of the brinkmanship, and it's another example of how it is so difficult when you have such diversity to get a set of rules, particularly when you have a kind of bureaucracy that is extraordinary rule-bound. And just to give you one more example of that kind of rule-bound bureaucracy, Spain is just recovering. I talked about the great news that it has only a 20% unemployment. And Portugal is just recovering. The European Commission said, oh, but look at your deficit. It's still over 3% of GDP. You have to have another big dose of austerity because you violated our rules. Your reaction was my reaction. Thank you. And this went on back and forth and back and forth. And eventually, the European Commission pulled back. And they said, next year you have to do it. So it's another example of a rigid bureaucracy alienating all the citizens, at the last minute recognizing it can't do what it says, but maybe more broadly, it's a bureaucracy and a set of institutions that are not out of sync with the democracies, and that is perhaps one of the most disturbing things, because it is undermining confidence in European democracy, and because the center left and the center right parties are both so supportive of the euro, is giving rise support to the more extremist parties, and of particular concern are the growth of the extremist parties on the right.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.